the US went from being the world's largest debtor to being the world's largest creditor, and lent a lot of money to both Britain and France. And it had the strongest economy. And in addition, it accumulated 60% of the world's reserves of gold. Now, the way the global financial system worked is gold was the primary currency. But in order for it to operate smoothly, everyone had to have some. I mean, you can't play Monopoly with one person accumulating all the money. And so when we came out of the First World War, the U.S. had too much of the world's gold. And as a consequence, the rest of the players in the system, and in particular France and Britain, felt compelled to sort of keep on, had to pay up to borrow money.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and have you ever had a book that you bought that you were really interested in, and it kind of sat on your shelf, and you'd look at it, and you wanted to grab it and read, and you didn't? I had that happen recently. Over the winter, I bought the latest book by Andrew Ross Sorkin on 1929, which I know our listeners are familiar with. And I kept seeing references to a book called Lords of Finance, a lot of references to it. And I'm thinking, I got to read that book. I went and pulled it off the shelf, read it, and it's an excellent companion to that book. And in fact, I think if you buy it, you'll learn a lot about the Great Depression and the causes, some of the reasons that may counteract common thinking. And I'm really, really pleased to have the author of that book with me today. He's Liaquat Ahmed, and he's the author of Lords of Finance, The Brit Bankers Who Broke the World. This book was written in 2009 in the middle of the Great Recession, but boy, it still has a lot of lessons for us today. Liaquat, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Robert.
Well, let's just start. I want to turn it over to you, the Lords of Finance. And this book is written, as a lot of great history is, through biography. Who are the Lords of Finance?
They are the four central bankers of the Western world, starting in the 1920s. The central figure is a man by the name of Montagu Norman, whose name doesn't mean anything today. But in the 1920s, he was the governor of the Bank of England and was viewed in much the same way that Alan Greenspan at his height was viewed, as sort of a wizard who understood finance. His background was that two of his grandfathers were on the board of the Bank of England. So being a central banker ran in his blood. The only deficiency he had was that he was manic depressive, and had been treated by Jung for a while. And that's probably not a good attribute for a central banker to have. And my book starts with the middle of the Great Depression, when Montagu Norman has had a nervous breakdown and has been forced to take 6 months off and recuperate in Canada. So he's the central character. The second central character is a man by the name of Benjamin Strong, who was the governor of the bank of the New York Fed. And he was the first, they weren't called presidents then, they were called governors, so he was the governor of the New York Fed. And he had taken that job when the Fed was created. He had been a banker at Bankers Trust. He was a lieutenant to J.P. Morgan when J.P. Morgan stabilized the U.S. banking system. And he was a very forceful character. And he understood the importance of having a stable international financial system. The third character in the book is a man by the name of Hjalmar Schacht, who's probably the smartest of all of them. He took over as governor of the Reichsbank, as president of the Reichsbank, in 1923, when he helped stabilize the mark. Germany, after the Second World War, went through a massive bout of hyperinflation, and he was centrally involved in stabilizing the Deutschmark and bringing inflation down from the four trillion percent that it was running at to a more reasonable number. He was one of these sort of people who had phenomenal political antenna. So he joined the German Central Bank in the middle of Weimar, the democratic system that of Germany in the 1920s, was responsible for a German economic miracle of the 1920s. And then when he saw that the whole thing was coming unraveled, and that's going to be part of the story we're going to talk about, he resigned and allied himself with Hitler, and then returned to office as Hitler's head of central bank and minister of finance in the early 1930s, and presided over a second economic miracle. This one very different. The first one had been based on borrowing a lot from abroad and opening the German economy. The second was based on autarky and creating a German economic miracle that was based on no imports and rationing of foreign exchange. He again, I should just finish his story, he fell afoul of Hitler in the lead up to the Second World War, because he thought the Germans were spending too much on armaments, spent the war essentially in opposition to Hitler, had hoped when the Allies liberated Germany that he would be invited to be the president of the post-war German Republic. Unfortunately, because of his association in the lead up to the Second World War, they arrested him and tried him at Nuremberg, and he was one of the few people who was actually acquitted, and then lived a long life, died in the late 50s, and was viewed as a sort of wise man of finance. And the fourth character was a man by the name of Émile Moreau, who was the head of the French Central Bank. And his characteristic was that he thought international finance was an Anglo-Saxon conspiracy designed to prevent France from achieving its right place in the world. He hated Montagu Norman, who he thought sort of conspired to keep France in its place, and spent the whole time trying to undermine the French. I mean, sorry, the British. He ended up doing a great job, but resigned in the late 20s, and went on to become a private banker. So those are the four characters, and the reason I chose them was it was a way of telling a global story, a macro story, but using individuals as vehicles for telling that story, so that it translated the sort of acrimony between the four major powers during the 20s and into the Great Depression into a personalized story about the relationship between these four men.
You know, I think there a lot of people think that this idea of globalization of the economy is a recent phenomenon, and this book shows that it's just the opposite. We've had this a long time, and this is a great story of how tied together the economy was back during this period. And I'll just say here for people out there listening in thinking, oh, international finance, that's technical, I won't understand it. I don't have that background, and I thought Liaquat, what you did an excellent job in making this very approachable for those of us that aren't experts on this, because it does get technical, but you explain it very well. So let's set the stage here. We've got these four, the Lords of Finance, and I love that title. What's kind of set the stage for us? What was happening? This was the post World War I era. How the economy was going, but how money and finance and just how that was set up during that time that may differ from now.
Yes, the First World War was a badly damaged the global financial system, and essentially in two ways. It was a financial catastrophe for Europe. You know, Europe, which had been the prime sort of financial center of the world, found itself saddled with a giant overhang of public debt, because each of them spent 50% of their GDP fighting the war. And so had to borrow an enormous amount, experience enormous inflation. Germany, between the beginning of the First World War and the end, saw its price level go up by 5-6 times. France, a similar amount. Britain, somewhat less, 2-3 times. And even the U.S., because of the global system. The U.S., and it also created a seismic shift in the balance of economic power. So the U.S. emerged. The U.S. went from being the world's largest debtor to being the world's largest creditor, and lent a lot of money to both Britain and France. It had the strongest economy. And in addition, it accumulated 60% of the world's reserves of gold. Now, the way the global financial system worked is gold was the primary currency. But in order for it to operate smoothly, everyone had to have some. I mean, you can't play Monopoly with one person accumulating all the money. And so when we came out of the First World War, the U.S. had too much of the world's gold, and as a consequence, the rest of the players in the system, and in particular France and Britain, felt compelled to sort of keep on had to pay up to borrow money. Superimposed upon that, because Britain and France had spent so much money in fighting the war, they believed that they had the right to demand repayment from Germany. And they imposed a giant fine on Germany. And when I say giant, I mean 500-600% of GDP. Now, no country can suddenly have a debt of 500-600% of its national income and hope to survive. And so essentially what happened was Germany was unable to pay, would print money in order to try to pay what it could, and experience hyperinflation. So the U.S. was trying to persuade Britain and France to go easy on Germany. Their response was, why don't you just reduce what we owe you? So everyone was pointing fingers at each other, saying, if only you would just be a little more generous, we could get out of this hole. So that was the situation in the mid-1920s.
And then you have, it's interesting reading about the gold standard. I read about it now, and it literally was dependent on the supply of gold, whether new sources were found and all. But that seemed to be, as you outlined, a major problem economically in the globe leading up to the Great Depression. How did this finally tip and leading to this economic hardship? And I think it's interesting, too, in your answer, if you could talk about it, it didn't seem to hit the United States at first. We avoided it.
No, it didn't. But let me just say one thing about the gold standard. It was an absurd system because people didn't actually hold the gold in their own banks. A lot of them said, well, in order to economize on transport, you know, gold is very bulky and difficult to transport. So they kept it all. A lot of them kept it in the vaults of the Bank of England. So when France lost gold and Britain gained gold, what would happen is there would be in the vaults of the Bank of England, someone would go to the section where the French gold was kept, and they'd pick up a lot of gold ingots and transfer it to the other side of the vault. So you would get the system where France felt beleaguered because there was too much gold in one side of the vault and not enough gold on the other side. The U.S., because it had so much of the world's gold reserves, did not feel constrained. And as a consequence, it did not have to keep interest rates unusually high. And it actually felt compelled to try to stabilize the system. Now, until the First World War, the linchpin of the global financial system was Britain and London and sterling. But it was very badly damaged. And Benjamin Strong, as the head of the Federal Reserve, struck up a great friendship with Montague Norman. They would go on vacation together. They would spend the summer in the resorts in the south of France together. So they were really good friends. And he thought the way to stabilize the global economy is to try to restore sterling to some of its old glory. And in order to do that, he said, what I need to do as the head of the Federal Reserve is to keep interest rates lower than I should do, because that will help the British. The dilemma is that by trying to help the British, he got the U.S. economy, which was then booming, we all know about the 1920s boom, he kept interest rates way too low for domestic purposes. So it was Benjamin Strong, despite his, you know, good intentions to try to help the British, who got the stock market bubble going. And what he did was he cut interest rates in the middle of 1927. They had a conference of central bankers on Long Island, of all places, and they had a secret meeting, and they agreed the way to try to help the British is for the Americans to cut interest rates. And the way the French the French central bank described it is, he gave a coup de whisky to sterling. But it probably, most people attribute the beginning of the stock market bubble to that decision. Because in the next 2 years, the stock market went up 200%.
Interesting. Well, first of all, you're listening out there to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson. I'm delighted to have as my guest today the author of Lords of Finance, The Bankers Who Broke the World. It's a 2009 book with applications for today. He's Liaquat Ahmed. I'm going to try to truncate a little bit because of time purposes, but Liaquat's kind of lay out here, you know, the main protagonist of the book, what things were like, what led to the Great Depression and ultimately World War II. You were very, I was trying to be polite. You called the gold standard an absurd system. So that's fine. But I'm curious. One of the major theories right now, and I still read this on the Wall Street Journal editorial page, is that Smoot-Hawley, the tariffs, are what led to the Great Depression. And that's a timely topic because of the tariffs that the president's implemented here. How do you feel about that?
Well, what led to the Great Depression was the fact that when the stock market crashed, initially the Fed did the right thing, but then everyone started competing for gold. So the British went out off the gold standard and attracted a whole lot of gold. Then the Americans felt compelled to hang on to their gold, so they raised interest rates. So you had four major countries in the world all scrambling for gold. And the only real way to do that was to keep on raising interest rates. Now, that might have been great if there was a boom going on, but in the middle of the Great Depression, Germany raised rates to 12%. The U.S., which had eased immediately after the crash, raised rates from 3% up to 6%. And that is what made that's what converted what would have been a bad recession, but not a great depression, into the Great Depression. Smoot-Hawley came very late in the process. Raising tariffs in the middle of 1930 and 31, it's hard to say whether it had zero effect or a negative effect, but in any case, the negative effect was probably very minor. That there was enough bad things going on, including banks going under. And I should have mentioned that the central problem in the U.S. Was when they started raising interest rates, banks got into trouble. They were not able to bail out the banks, and the banking system crumbled. And you had a 30% reduction in the number of banks, a 30% reduction in bank credit available in the middle of the Great Depression, which just exacerbated all the problems.
What are the lessons for today? I've got two questions left for you. You can take just a couple minutes on each one. What are the major lessons for today?
I think the two lessons for today. One is that if central bankers try to have too many goals, they end up achieving none of them. So in the case of the 1920s and 30s, I think the Fed essentially had two irreconcilable objectives: to save the pound sterling and to manage the U.S. economy. And by doing what it did, it achieved neither. The second is that when countries start competing with each other, conducting either monetary policy or fiscal policy or any economic policy in a sort of competitive way, it can lead to a giant spiral downwards in the global economy. I think one of the saving graces this last year. One of the saving graces of when the Trump tariffs were raised this time last year, the big risk would have been if other countries had retaliated. And then we would have got into this a spiral of tit for tat. And it, for a brief moment, for about a month, it looked as if we might be getting into that. Remember when the U.S. raised tariffs on China, and then China raised them on the U.S., and it looked, you know, both of them had gone to 150% tariffs on each other's goods. And that was sort of, I think they understood they were looking over the cliff at Armageddon. And so...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And so they both figured out that this is not going to do us, either of us, any good. So now we've come down to much more reasonable levels.
I have one last question. This is a great book. We barely scratched the surface of it. I recommend it to our listeners. But you've got a new book coming out. I've already got it pre-ordered, and I'll have you back after I read it, and we'll talk about it. But share with our listeners in just a minute or two a little bit about this book.
This book is a sort of prequel to Lords of Finance. It's about the crisis of 1873. And which was the first truly global financial crisis, in which you got a boom, a 20-year boom, based on massive borrowing, which then caused a series of bubbles, excess borrowing by the railroads in the U.S., a stock market bubble in Central Europe, and excessive borrowing by emerging markets, including the Ottoman Empire and Egypt. And all of these came to a head in 1873, when all of these bubbles burst.
I've got 30 seconds. What got you interested in this topic?
I used to be in the investment management business, and got caught in a couple of financial crises, lost money, and decided the best way of trying to avoid losing money is to study the past.
Well, you did a great service, I think, to folks that are interested in this topic, and even the general public, again, out there. This gets into some technical aspects of money that, if you're like me, you know, your eyes glaze over. But Liaquat does this in a very approachable way, and I think it's for a general audience. I think you do fine with it reading. Very important stuff for today, and it's very well written. I'm just really thankful that you took the time today, Liaquat Ahmed, who's the author of Lords of Finance, The Bankers Who Broke the World, and stay tuned. We'll have him back to talk about his new book later in the fall. Liaquat, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.